This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
The votes have been counted, and the answer is no. Amazon warehouse workers in Alabama are not getting a union, so now what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 9th. Good to have you with us. We're going to get to that Amazon news in a bit, but I'll take location privilege and start here in Washington, where the Biden administration today released its discretionary budget proposal for next year. Discretionary spending covers roughly a third of the federal budget, and President Biden is asking Congress to approve over $1.5 trillion for various administration priorities. To dig into that story and other economic news of the week, we have two of our Friday regulars, Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal and Heather Long at the Washington Post. Welcome.
Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Kimberly.
Kate, let's start with you. You wrote about the budget proposal for the Journal today. What are the big takeaways?
Sure. So I think the big takeaway is this is really a reflection of President Biden's economic vision here, that the government can do a lot more to improve Americans' lives. And you're seeing this in investments that he wants to make in, high poverty schools and research into Alzheimer's and diabetes. And the budget would increase non-defense spending by 16%, which is just a huge number over enacted levels from last year. That would bring non-defense spending back up to about 3.3% as a share of GDP. That's the average over 30 years. And that's really important because the argument that the administration is making is that these kinds of investments have sort of gone by the wayside. We've spent a lot more money on the military, for example, in recent decades, and these other kinds of core services have sort of gotten short shrift in their view. And so this budget proposal is kind of an effort to realign some of those things.
Heather, can you place that for me in the context of the other ways that Biden is trying to accomplish his agenda? We've had COVID relief, the infrastructure plan in the works. How does this all fit into it?
Well, his message has been for a year now to put people first, and this is very much a budget that aligns with those priorities. Obviously, there was that huge stimulus package that passed in March that was providing immediate relief right away to the nation's families and businesses. The infrastructure plan is an investment for the next 5 to 8 years, and this budget proposal really fills in the remaining gaps. What really stood out to me is the biggest department that would see the biggest increases is education. And it's kind of hard to argue that in a global competitive race, as the United States competes with countries around the world, we probably do need to boost education spending.
You mentioned, and you cover this a lot, Heather, about this sort of people-first economy. That kind of lines up with what Powell, Fed Chair Powell, was saying at the IMF this week, really focusing in on unemployment.
That's right. It was a pretty stunning comment to come from a Federal Reserve chair. Normally, these folks are more known for talking about wonky details on inflation and the numbers. And instead, he painted this portrait that every day when he drives home from the Federal Reserve building in Washington, D.C., back to his home in Chevy Chase, Maryland, he talked about passing a homeless tent city, like a bunch of tents where homeless live, and how much that impacts him. And he talked about this quote, "I really want to finish the job and get back to a great economy." And that's really been, since he took over as Fed chair, what he's really done that's different from his predecessors is basically say, forget inflation, forget these models of the past. Our focus needs to be on getting as many people back to work as possible. You know, basically, his campaign slogan could be full employment 2022. And it's a big sea change at the Fed, but it's very much in line with the Biden administration. He's basically arm in arm with Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and wanting to do everything possible to run this economy hot for the next 2 years and ensure that we not just get all the people back to work who lost jobs during the pandemic, but hopefully we get even more people, some of those people who are currently living in those tent cities, back to on track as well.
Kate, I'm really struck by what Heather just said, because having the Fed and the administration in lockstep is unusual in recent years.
That's right. I mean, I can think back to, it was really not so long ago. I mean, it was at the beginning of Fed Chair Jay Powell's tenure when we were monitoring Twitter to look for, you know, what was the latest criticism from President Trump? What was he going to say today about the Fed chair? And at that time, you know, the president was calling for lower interest rates. And I think when the pandemic happened, the Fed moved very quickly to lower rates. And so he kind of got back on to President Trump's good side. But sure, it was a complicated relationship, if you will, and I think a tense relationship, at least from the president's perspective. I think Jay Powell, whenever he was asked about it, would obviously say that the Fed doesn't pay attention to politics and just focuses on its mandate. But right, it is interesting now when you hear, you know, just a couple weeks ago, we saw Jay Powell and Janet Yellen testify together on Capitol Hill. And it seemed very much like they were kind of backing each other up, even, for example, on climate change. That's an area where I think the Fed has gotten some political pushback from Republicans for wading into an area that they see as beyond the Fed's remit. It's something that the Biden Treasury really cares about. And Powell and Yellen were kind of, I think, backing each other up on the idea that it's important for regulators to be thinking about that issue. So that's another space where, yeah, they're working together for sure.
So the budget proposal is one thing. Great that, you know, the Fed and the White House are working together, but there is still Congress to address. And the infrastructure package that the Biden administration has been selling all week. There was a lot of tension this week, Heather, on corporate taxes. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, of course, anytime you suggest raising corporate taxes, the reception was lukewarm, to put it kindly, from a lot of the big business community and lobbying groups immediately saying, no way, can we go up to 28%? And of course, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, that key swing vote from on the Democratic side, also sort of saying, not too keen on 28. But Kimberly, I think if you listen closely, the White House is actually very happy this week, because people aren't saying, no way in heck can we raise these taxes. What they're actually saying is, we don't really like 28. Could we maybe do 25 instead? So you're already hearing negotiating, but it's not like it's a flat out, you know, no. I think, and that's a good sign. The other thing that happened this week is it was a very warm welcome overseas to this idea of a global minimum tax. So you heard the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, France and Germany all applauding the Biden administration for doing this idea that there needs to be some base level of taxation on corporations around the world.
Kate, last word for you in the last couple seconds. Where do you think we're going to end up landing on the corporate tax rate?
Oh my gosh, I could make a lot of money, couldn't I, Kimberly? If I knew that and could place some bets. I really don't know, but I mean, I think Heather's right. I think it does seem like there's certainly some room for compromise here, and a lot of it will come down to, you know, what does Joe Manchin want? I think when Kai comes back, he might have to change up his regular what is Jay Powell thinking to what is Joe Manchin thinking going forward here.
A brand new game. Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal and Heather Long at the Washington Post. Thank you both so much and have a good weekend.
Thank you so much. You too.
On Wall Street today, more record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To the big labor news today, Amazon employees at a warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, have voted against forming a union. For months, the retail, wholesale, and department store union has been trying to organize the just over 5,800 workers. The effort drew national attention from corporations, workers, labor activists, celebrities, even politicians. Amazon is the country's second largest private employer, and with a rapidly expanding warehouse workforce that has been crucial to the company's growth during the pandemic. But in the end, workers voted by a landslide against unionizing. Marketplace's Jasmine Gartz has more.
It looked like the union could win, but the no vote was not a big surprise to Todd Vachon at the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. He says U.S. labor law benefits employers.
And it makes it very difficult to organize a union in the United States. There's just so many obstacles in the way and so many opportunities for the employer to instill fear in the workers, to disseminate misinformation.
For example, Bessemer workers reported anti-union text messages and signs in bathrooms, as well as mandatory meetings. Celine McNicholas is with the Economic Policy Institute.
You know, Amazon certainly, from all accounts, engaged in, you know, a campaign against the union, and that there's likely some elements that violate the National Labor Relations Act in there.
The Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union has said it will challenge the vote with the National Labor Relations Board. David Madland, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, says the Bessemer vote is a blow to organized labor.
But I think it also really highlights the need for legal reforms to make it possible for workers who want to join a union to be able to do so.
In a statement, Amazon says it did not intimidate workers and does not consider this a win. Quote, "Our employees made the choice to vote against joining a union." I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
With big corporations playing such a big role in politics and labor, governments all over the world are cracking down on just who can control key businesses. There is growing international scrutiny around Chinese efforts to buy companies in particular. Italy's president revealed that his country blocked a Chinese firm from acquiring an Italian microchip manufacturer. And here in the U.S., just yesterday, the Commerce Department stopped seven Chinese firms from buying American-made technologies. Other government agencies are reviewing past deals. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor has more on what's going on.
From North America to Europe and East Asia, governments are paying more attention to who is buying up their companies in certain sectors. That's especially true when the buyer is based in China.
The Europeans think that China intends to squeeze out their companies.
James Lewis is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The Germans look at car manufacturing. Chinese are trying to elbow them out. In Europe, it's very much an economic concern.
In the U.S., the stated concern around Chinese companies is national security, usually, though not always, in high-tech sectors like semiconductors. Damian Ma is with the Paulson Institute think tank.
So anytime we talk about very high-value technology, it's almost inevitable that they're dual use. You know, chips go into your phones and chips also, you know, go into, you know, fighter jets.
China has its own set of restrictions on foreign companies and a blacklist. It, too, wants to reduce its vulnerabilities. Tatiana Bolton is with public policy research group, the R Street Institute.
There's a global power shift. China's rising. The United States arguably is falling. And so this brings about a lot of different concerns for both nations as they change in the power dynamics of the global order.
Global supply chains have been weaving themselves tightly across borders for decades. Now, as countries examine and cut individual threads of international trade, the question is what happens to the fabric. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Every morning, David Brancaccio and Sabri from time to time, as well as the rest of the team, bring you the economic news you need to start your day. Check them out on the Marketplace Morning Report. Coming up,
this might look pretty good above my couch or my bed or in my office.
Feels like we're all redecorating these days. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 297 points, 0.8%, to finish at 33,800. The NASDAQ gains 70 points, 0.5%, to end at 13,900. And the S&P found 31 points, 0.7%, to land at 4,128. For the week, the Dow rose 1.9%, the NASDAQ added 3.1%, the S&P 500 gained 2.7%. As we heard from Jasmine, workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, have voted not to unionize. Amazon is up 2.2% today. Target rose 0.9%. Walmart stayed flat. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. We've been talking about the big picture economic recovery, but there are other recoveries underway as well. It's been nearly 2 months since a winter storm brought the first billion-dollar natural disaster of 2021, and some estimates say the freezing temperatures, ice, and snow in the American South were even more costly than Hurricane Harvey in 2017. In Texas, where freezing temperatures lingered for 3 or 4 days, that meant a lot of burst pipes in apartment buildings, houses, offices, everywhere. Weeks after the storm, a lot of those pipes still aren't working, and that's because plumbers are still really busy. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent the day with one very popular plumber to get a sense of the job.
A little after 11 a.m. on a recent Friday, 31-year-old Matthew Avalos gets out of his company van at a two-story brick house in North Austin. He's wearing a navy blue Radiant Plumbing t-shirt and a black face mask. He's here to check on a big puddle in the front yard that's forced the homeowners to shut off their water.
I do a lot of leak detection. I'm kind of the leak guy.
To fix the leak at this house, the first thing he does is remove the metal cover from the main shutoff valve at the street.
We're just going to kind of go over here to the meter side of things. We're just going to turn the water on and kind of see if we can see where this water's coming from. Oh, and we got it right there.
He says it's hard to tell whether this leak was caused by the freeze or the tree roots that he has to dig around to get to a crack in the PVC pipe that drains from the house out to the city's sewer system. Now that he's found the culprit, he says the fix is relatively simple. So he grabs a reciprocating saw, PVC pipe fittings, and some glue out of the van.
And what I'm going to create is what's called a swing joint. It just makes gluing it all together. Pretty simple. That way I'm not trying to force anything together.
Avalo says finally, 2 months after the storm, he's able to get to less urgent jobs like this one, because for the last 2 months, the phone calls were the same emergency over and over again.
Split pipe, split pipe, split pipe. At the beginning of all this, we had 1,500 calls that were scheduled.
1,500 customers waiting for service, and that's just one plumbing company in Austin. Nearly every plumber in the state has been working nonstop to meet the demand. Avalo says everyone at Radiant was working weekends and taking on whatever jobs they could to help folks after the freeze, which he feels good about. He actually never imagined plumbing was the line of work he'd end up in.
Honestly, I was in retail for like 7 years. I was in retail.
Working at Walmart, Kohl's, and Academy Sporting Goods. Then about 10 years ago...
One day I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he's a plumber. And he goes, "Do you mind getting your hands dirty?" And I was like, "No." And he goes, "All right, well then, come do this."
As he digs deeper to get some more room for the piping he's about to install, he says there's another part of plumbing that has a leg up on his old jobs.
Yeah, money's definitely a good plus compared to retail. I know this was back in 2012 when I started, but as an apprentice, I was making just as much as I was as a customer service manager at Walmart.
And as a result of the freeze, he was able to make a bunch of cash he wasn't expecting to. After saying goodbye to the customer at this job, he grabs his tablet and lets his bosses know that he's ready to move on.
All right, that's done. Everything's been paid for.
Total bill for this job, $1,200.
Close out, job's complete. Now that I've done that, they've been notified that I'm done.
And then, almost immediately...
So it looks like they're sending me to my next one. It says leak coming from the second story to the first story through the ceiling. The bathroom, there's a bathroom above it. So no telling what it'll be.
Avalo says he likes that about plumbing. Sure, it can be dirty sometimes, but he enjoys the troubleshooting and problem solving of it all. And in times like these, when plumbers are in such high demand, he says he also enjoys the job security. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
With a lot more people working from home and suddenly caring about what shows up behind them in a Zoom meeting, there's a new appetite for fine art. According to the UBS Global Art Market Report, which is put out by Art Basel, while overall sales were down, online art sales worldwide doubled in 2020. And wealthy millennials were the main buyers. Everett Taylor is the chief marketing officer at Artsy, one of the largest fine art online marketplaces. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
With the caveat that so many people lost jobs and income in the pandemic, for those who did have disposable income, a lot of people still wanted to buy art. What did you see at Artsy?
Yeah, it was incredible to see online sales went up and really saw incredible growth. And I think really the only explanation to that is that people are spending more time in their homes, and we're looking around. We're like, hey, this might look pretty good above my couch or my bed or in my office.
Has that changed the type of art that's being purchased?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Artsy being a tech company, we have all of this data. And time after time, our most in-demand artists, several of them in our top 10 are artists of color now, and not just white male artists. People value different types of art, and there's an audience out there for them, but you have to be able to have the ability and the wherewithal to actually promote that art and give it a platform.
Artists from underrepresented groups, new artists, there's a lot of concern about the churn in the market and people speculating on their art and buying it very quickly, reselling it, and the artists themselves not getting the profit. How does Artsy play into that whole dynamic?
Artsy is a platform. We try to equip, you know, our galleries and the artists that are represented by galleries with the tools to be successful. But at the end of the day, you can't stop people from making bad decisions.
But Artsy and the other digital platforms are making it easier to do this because it's faster. People can see the art. They can buy it sight unseen. Do there need to be more guardrails to protect the artist and the galleries?
Yeah, but the galleries can still have a buyer's agreement where, you know, that person can't sell that art for 5 years or et cetera, et cetera. You know, I've bought art plenty of times where I have to sign something that says, hey, I can't flip this work or sell this work for X amount of time.
You just mentioned you are a collector yourself. From that perspective, what other changes do you want to see in the art market overall?
Oh, man, it's so many. I think I want to see it be a more inclusive place and see collectors of color get access to artists of color. It's like this person is literally painting from a Black narrative and Black people can't get access to the work. That's a fundamental issue. You know, you just talked about like not having guardrails, but part of not having guardrails is continuing to get to a point of democratization. You know, when you're opening up that space, it gives more fair chance for people to gain access to the work, and you don't have to necessarily deal with the art world politics.
Politics everywhere. Everett Taylor is CMO at Artsy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, we were talking about Amazon and that big union vote earlier and mentioned it was the second largest private employer in the country. Well, here's some news about number one, Walmart. People are shopping a bit differently these days, doing more online ordering and curbside pickup, which means less in-store eating. That's why McDonald's is closing hundreds of its restaurants inside the big box stores all over the country, according to the Wall Street Journal. Just not enough foot traffic. Subway, which also has locations in some Walmarts, says it will close some of its in-store locations as well. Your moment of economic context on this Friday. We were talking earlier about President Biden's budget proposal. This is, of course, just what the administration is asking of Congress, not necessarily what Biden is going to get. Some extra breakdown on that. Like Kate Davidson mentioned earlier, the budget proposal calls for a 16% increase in domestic programs over current funding levels. That compares to a 1.7% increase for the military. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you Monday. Everybody, have a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.